session would restrict the mixed martial arts, both professional and amateur, and professional boxing match competitors to be at least 18 years old. And the amendments also decrease the civil penalty amount from the maximum $250,000 in the original bill to $100,000, and it puts language in the bill, and you'll see that on lines 19 of the first page of the amendment, how the commission will establish civil penalties, saying that they will include consideration of gross receipts of the sale of tickets if the violation is related to an event, and also take into consideration the severity of the violation and the number of previous violations committed by the person they're imposing the penalty against. There is also an amendment requested by Senator Bates' office allowing medical committee members to be appointed as ringside physicians and to be paid by promoters.
Where's that one?
That's also in the dash 4 amendment.
Oh, it's yeah, right. It's in it. Yeah, okay. Okay. Mr. Darcy, you want to come forward?
That's lines, Mr. Chair, that's lines 10 through 15 of the amendment.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
As you know, we had a lively discussion about some of these issues, and I just, maybe if you could, Janet's told us what the changes are, but to give us your perspective on how you arrived at each one of those as pertains to the, you know, committee concerns.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate being here today. My name is Brad Darcy. I'm the director of the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission. These amendments were basically offered through our discussion in the initial hearing, addressing concerns and issues raised by the committee. And Janet did an excellent job of summarizing those. But basically, the bill is designed to update what the commission does in relation to the activity going on in the state, and what's initiated it originally is to address the cage fighting that was going on throughout the state. And I believe these amendments help us do that. The bill in its totality will give us the tools to control this new activity in a way that lets it continue, but in a safe, more regulated environment. Would you like me to go each one, or?
Well, let's see what we have questions on.
Sure.
Questions from the committee on any of the amendments. We had talked about the fee schedule, and we talked about the age of the professionals, as well as the concern about being able to recruit physicians ringside. I know those are attempted to be solved in this amendment. Senator George, you had talked about the fees, and
it's okay.
Is that okay with you? Okay. Senator Starr, do you have any questions?
Just a quick question. What's the rationale with 18 years of age?
There was a concern that I agree with raised by the committee that allowing minors to participate in these events creates an undue hazard, and that's what we're addressing by disabling.
I'd raise that one about that as a professional. Right. At least they should be 18.
So this is for professional kinds of matches. We're not talking about
taxes. Well, if they're mixed martial arts,
right,
as a professional boxer.
It applies both to amateur and professional mixed martial arts.
In this particular arena.
Correct.
Right. It doesn't change amateur boxing or
anything
like that.
No, none of what we've done today affects the sport of amateur boxing.
But what about, Mr. Chair? Mm-hmm. Like things like taekwondo or those type?
Our definition in this bill basically defines mixed martial arts to not include those kinds of sports. The karate, the point karate,
yes.
There are also like submission tournaments that take place. That's actually a sport that's growing also alongside this. That's a non-striking sport, so it would allow that to be not affected by this bill.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. Can you point me toward the definition of mixed martial arts in the bill? Okay, I see it. On page 2, line 34, is that where?
Yeah.
Uh, And we're certain that this would not incorporate karate or taekwondo or the kinds of martial arts that numerous individuals are participating in. I mean, I've got my kids, obviously, are young, but they're involved in taekwondo if they were to continue to move up through the system.
Correct. We've made every effort to make sure this definition would not include that. And we've put in, like, language, achieve dominance, combative sporting contest, and then including all the striking, grappling, and submission holds.
Okay. So, and let's say record, hopefully it'll be clear.
Yeah.
That's not what we're, that we are working on here.
Because, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When I read the definition of mixed martial arts on page 2, line 34, it means a combative sporting contest in which two mixed martial arts competitors attempt to achieve dominance over one another.
Right.
Sounds like taekwondo and karate to me.
That's been the definition's been a challenge to come up with. That our intent, though, is to not include those sports.
Well, do you regulate those sports?
No.
No, I mean,
we've never had the authority over.
I mean, the commission. Yeah, I mean, as I say, all this is under the umbrella of this particular commission's authority, not.
Mr. Chair, my fear is that we're broadening the commission's authority if we include a definition that's too broad and it incorporates these other martial arts that a lot of Oregonians participate in of all ages.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and that is, like I was saying, this is an attempt to not go into that arena. The definition that we apply right now to the mixed martial arts is wrestling, and that definition was never intended to apply to those sports or even the sports that we're applying them to now. Like I said, our intent is absolutely not to broaden into those areas.
Well, yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, this is on a different subject, but Senator Bates' office was interested in getting on the record that the pre-fight medical exam would include a test for bloodborne diseases, not in the statute, but as part of the intention for the rulemaking.
Okay. So. Well, back to our other issue, though. So, there appears to be some concern in the committee that your definition. They're worried that if somehow it could be give you governance of something that you're not supposed to have governance of, I guess is the best way I could put it. I mean, I don't know that that's the case, but I don't know who can arbitrate that definition to say whether you would have authority to, do something differently than what you're doing now. I'm kind of at a loss to figure out how to do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, couldn't we specifically name the martial arts that wouldn't be incorporated in? I mean, I don't know them all, but mm-hmm. I know too, karate and taekwondo. I'm sure there's others
mm-hmm.
that you specifically could identify that this would not, the definition would not incorporate.
Okay.
I'll tell you what. Why don't we do this? Because there's just enough doubt here. I think what we need to have you do is you need to work with legislative counsel on page 2, lines 34 through 37, right? Which basically is the definition we're talking about. Is to have some clarity as to what that covers and to make some specific prohibitions, I guess, to other things if there's any doubt about it, so that your rule of authority is over what you want to be ruling over, and someone doesn't come to the Athletic Association, or is what we're naming it now, and say that you have authority over something that was not intended. I don't know who wrote the bill, Janet, but if you could work with Mr. Darcy on that, with the concerns of the committee, and just make sure that the types of activity that we're talking about is, in fact, covered in that definition, does not overextend to, kids taekwondo or adult taekwondo, for that matter, or any of that kind of stuff. I understand. I agree. I don't want that.
Further question?
Yeah.
Did in Section 2, where we eliminate the ban on, what do you call it, extreme fighting, did Senator Deckert, did he, was he okay with that? Because I believe the Senator Deckert's bill in 97 that got that added to the statute.
I think you talked about that definition. Would you want to go over that again?
Mr. Chair, if you'd like, we can do this off.
Yeah, but I'd like to hear from the committee what the, because I remind us of that. There was a you originally had that definition and you wanted to move away from it.
Right. That definition was originally intended to eliminate what was going on at the time, and justifiably that there were these no-holds-barred competitions going on, and it was defined at that time as extreme fighting. It's basically a combative sport with no restrictions, no rules. And so what we've done is basically defined the allowable activity as mixed martial arts, and we would then basically prohibit anything that wouldn't meet that standard. So it does not reverse and let us go back to allowing no-holds-barred competitions. You basically have to meet this definition as mixed martial arts, or it's not an allowable activity.
I see. Okay.
Okay.
And one other question. On page 2, line 40, when you change the word employee to matchmaker, tell me again, is that because there are some employees that do not need to be licensed?
Yes. We were historically licensing box office employees, security personnel, and ticket takers, and with the number of events we're going to have, and that's always been a pretty cumbersome standard to meet at all the events, to get an application and take a fee and process and administrate that process for that many employees. So we've limited the scope of that to event personnel related to the conduct of the competition and the integrity of the event. We can, by administrative rule, require that the promoter provide adequate and competent, you know, for example, security personnel, and intend to do that. But we don't want to go as far as licensing each of those individuals.
Okay. All right. So, Janet, Mr. Darcy, let's work on make sure that our definition of what we're covering is correct, and then we'll bring it back again. Close the work session on Senate Bill 492, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 734, Janet.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 734 is a bill that would allow banks to issue stocks to directors, officers, or employees for services rendered, and what would require that the such a stock issuance plan be approved by at least two-thirds of the holders of outstanding shares of the institution's stock. The also requires that the DCBS approve the stock issuance plan. The Dash 1 amendments clarify that the threshold for approving such a stock issuance is holders of at least two-thirds of the outstanding shares instead of two-thirds of the holders of the shares. And the Dash 1 amendments are at your place, and this is billed as at the request of Oregon Bankers Association, and representatives are here.
You want to come up, Mr. Martinez? And
Mr. Chairman,
welcome.
Members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. Oregon Medical. I'm in two places at once.
I know how it is when you're just, you know, such high demand, you just don't know where you are. Yeah.
Oregon Bankers Association. These amendments were at our request, and Community Administrator accurately described them as making sure they were clarifying and the language that we were looking for, so we very much support the amendments to 734 and would ask you to incorporate them into the bill and move the bill on.
Okay. We had this bill last week.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 734.
Senator Starr moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 734. Any discussion on the amendment? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 734 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Monsanders, I know you had some questions about holding companies and all that, and do you feel comfortable with that now?
Feel comfortable with it now.
Okay. Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, so ordered. You can mark Senator George votes aye. And back. Mark Senator Deckard as excused. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 734, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 827.
Who's carrying the other one?
I guess I'll carry it. You guys get the rest of them.
Thank you.
Okay. Janet, 827.
No, 827.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 827 would create an urban growth boundary expansion area revolving fund. And I spelled that out, and it's going to be UGBARL, UGBEARL.
Yeah.
I don't think that's very catchy, but UGBARL. And this would be a fund that would provide low-interest loans for infrastructure projects in areas of UGB expansion since 1997. It would authorize $25 million of payment from lottery revenues for the fund in addition to any amounts that were necessary for bond administration. Would direct the Oregon Economic Development Community Development Department to administer the loan program, and it would take effect July 1st. Whoops. That's a long ways away. 2007. Mr. Chair, we are awaiting amendments from council directly that would eliminate the requirement that a borrower from the fund be the city that expanded its urban growth boundaries and would allow both cities and counties to borrow from the fund. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Monis Anderson, this is your bill.
Okay, thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. The city of Gresham has actually brought this bill to the legislature, and there are currently, well, the city of Gresham is responsible for two of the largest urban growth boundary expansions in the state, and there are currently inadequate tools and resources to cover the startup costs for the infrastructure necessary to begin development in these areas. And this is a tool that could help those communities who do not have the startup costs. And I would like for you to bring representatives from Gresham up to talk about the details of the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So go ahead and bring your folks up.
Ron Papsdorf.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Ron Papsdorf. I represent the city of Gresham, for the record. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The city of Gresham brought this bill forward and supports Senate Bill 827 because it assists our local economic development efforts and will help cities and counties implement urban growth boundary expansion areas. When their urban growth boundary is expanded, there are expectations that development should be able to proceed within a reasonable time frame. However, preparing these areas for development can be extremely difficult. In many cases, the funding for essential infrastructure to begin development in these areas occurs when development happens, but we need the infrastructure in place to even allow the first development to begin within an urban growth boundary expansion area. So we have a catch-22 on the funding. Making these areas available for development, especially industrial job creation, is a vital concern to both local jurisdictions and the state of Oregon. And preparing them for development is an important step in that process. As the senator stated earlier, we have inadequate tools and resources available right now to make those first critical investments. These areas typically have no urban infrastructure whatsoever in place when the UGB, the Urban Growth Boundary, is expanded. Without some additional tools, important economic development will be significantly delayed. We've seen that time and time again. In Gresham's case, we've had one urban growth boundary expansion area adjacent to our city that occurred. The decision occurred in 1998. We've completed the planning process, and we're still facing financial difficulties with development partners to just get some key infrastructure pieces in place so that they can just begin the development process. That situation repeats itself time and time again throughout the state in many urban growth boundary expansion areas. As Janet said, Senate Bill 827 creates a new revolving loan program for essential infrastructure that are precursors to development. within these areas that have been expanded since 1997. It makes no interest loans available for essential infrastructure development so that we can work with our private partners to actually start that development process within those areas. Senate Bill 827 doesn't really fund all of the infrastructure per se. It's really strategically focused at breaking the cash flow problem we have to just begin the development process. Nor does it preempt important local dialogue that happens with the communities during the planning process once an urban growth boundary expansion decision has been made. Those discussions with the community really get us to the point where everyone has agreed to what the area needs to be, what the infrastructure necessary to serve that area at build out is, how to pay for that infrastructure over time. This very narrowly focuses on just the initial cash flow issue so that we can begin that process. The Home Builders Association of Oregon and the League of Oregon Cities have allowed me to also represent to you their support of this bill. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Pastor. Well, first of all, you have identified a real problem, and I know Ms. Rich from Special Districts has signed up, and I'll have her come forward in a moment. And even though he has not signed up, I'm going to ask Mr. Chandler, because he is in the back room, to come forward too. But you have identified certainly a problem that we have with our UGB expansions, because I think most people, I mean, the general public, when they talk about UGB expansions in the metro area, they always go on. There's a real thought among the public that once you've expanded, that means it's being developed. And, you know, that isn't the case. And I believe the last statistic I saw was that on average it takes 6 years from an expansion to there's actually any development. So when you talk about accommodating growth, it doesn't really happen. And part of the discussions people have in terms of UGB expansion is that, well, we don't need any more because we, for example, Damascus. But no one's figured out how to even put infrastructure there yet, much less the 60,000 people. And it is that problem of, you know, where does the money from infrastructure come? So, I mean, you certainly have identified a key problem. Senator Starr.
Thank you. Who pays the money back?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr. Really, that's a decision at the local level based on that discussion within the community about what the best mechanisms are at the local level to pay for infrastructure over time. In the case of the city of Gresham, through our long planning processes for both the Pleasant Valley Urban Growth Boundary Expansion Area as well as the Springwater Urban Growth Boundary Expansion Area, those decisions were made during a long deliberate planning process, and in our case, most of the vast majority of the infrastructure is funded through citizens development charge mechanisms, charges that are assessed to development to pay for growth-related infrastructure impacts.
So, Mr. Chair, if and I guess further follow-up, if we amended the bill to make it specific that the developers that are going to benefit from the growth in the urban growth boundary expansion area would pay for this, you know, would pay back the loan so the local government can jumpstart the infrastructure that's necessary. You wouldn't oppose that if we amended this bill to make it specific that developers that are going to benefit from the development in the urban growth boundary expansion area would pay to refund or repay this loan. That would be okay with you,
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr. I'm quite frankly not sure, and let me explain why. There are some infrastructure pieces that primarily might benefit an urban growth boundary expansion area, but given their adjacency to an existing urban community, there also may be some benefit for that of that infrastructure for the existing community, and there may very well be a reasonable nexus between some general contribution towards that infrastructure element from the broader community and development within the urban growth boundary expansion area itself may not appropriately have to bear the full cost of that infrastructure investment. I can think of perhaps a fire station that might serve a much larger area than just the urban growth boundary expansion area. It may have some benefit for the adjacent existing community as well. There are street improvements that extend from the existing community into the expansion area that also might have some level of benefit for the existing community, where there might be an appropriate level of some investment in that facility while the majority of the cost is carried by the developers within the expansion area itself. So at least I think the city's position would be those are the kinds of discussions and decisions that are best left to the local jurisdictions in partnership with their communities to decide how best to finance that infrastructure over time.
Mr. Chair, just let me be real clear where I'm coming from on this. We have one of these in my county, and I'll guarantee you that my constituents who live in Western Washington County have no desire whatsoever to be taxed to pay for development that occurs in another part of the county. And I am adamant that folks in Hillsborough shouldn't have to pay for infrastructure that goes into Bethany, for instance. And if the development community that speculated in land in Bethany made bad financial decisions, they should have to live with that, and my constituents shouldn't have to pay for it. And I would submit that the broader folks in Gresham shouldn't have to pay for, you know, specific infrastructure that goes into the expansion of an urban area outside of their core area. You know, those are issues that I think are really, really touchy. And I'm afraid that unless we get this really clear, I'm going to have a hard time supporting this particular bill. I understand, you know, the catch-22 the city's in, but historically, as expansion development has occurred, the development community who's benefited from that development have paid for that infrastructure. We've had this argument and this discussion in this building for a long time about education, you know, and growth and education, and not they ought to pay for it. Well, you know, this we're talking about clear nexus between development and the infrastructure necessary to serve that development. The development and the developers and those that are moving in there ought to pay for that. It's a clear nexus, a clear connection. The rest of the community, I don't believe, should have to pay for it.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Senator Starr, not disregarding the particular concern you have for an area within your district, which I fully understand, In our case, there is, for instance, a very specific sewer line and sewer improvement project that is primarily necessary to serve the Pleasant Valley Urban Growth Boundary Expansion Area. But a component of that project also benefits existing neighborhoods and existing urban development within the city of Gresham itself. And so that's where my concern comes from with a straight-out limit on any other type of in participation in an infrastructure project, because there can be in some cases some reasonable and some necessary in participation in the cost for a project that primarily serves an urban growth boundary expansion area but also has benefit for an existing community.
Well, you and I don't necessarily disagree very far, and I bet we can craft some language that would clarify it and make it real clear.
Any other questions for Ron before we ask others up? Why don't you go ahead and stay there so we can get cozy here. Amanda and John, why don't you come forward? You've both heard a couple of the questions Senator Starr has raised, and you've been quoted already, Mr. Chandler, so it would only be appropriate that you come forward. But I'm going to start with the lady because she signed up. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here this afternoon representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. And we think this is a terrific bill, and we're really glad that the City of Gresham brought it forward and highlighted this this issue. We have one area of concern. It doesn't have to do actually with the text of the bill you have in front of you. It's our understanding, our conceptual understanding of the amendments that will be coming forward. They were technical fix amendments to try to address an issue, but they now would limit the eligible entities to cities and counties and not include special districts. And as you know, special districts are service providers for many of the services that are talked about in this bill. And so we're working with the city and hoping that we can get that worked out. If not here, then in the next committee. This little bill needs to get moving because it has a long voyage ahead of it to revenue and then on to ways and means. But other than that, we would just like to express our support and, you know, would like to be partners in getting this bill going.
Okay.
So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chandler, give us your thoughts on both this bill and also how it impacts your clients and Senator Starr's comments about, you know, who should front the cost for infrastructure and whether this is a positive step and, you know, developers should pay for it. What's your thoughts on all this?
Senator Metzger, member of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here reviewing my choice of which committee to attend this afternoon.
Thank you very much for choosing us. You made the right choice.
Bit of a drive-by. We support Senate Bill 827, and I think what this bill is getting at, and what Senator Starr's question is getting at, is something we all overlooked in the planning system in Oregon, which is how do you pay for things once you move the urban growth boundary? Inside the boundary, we've had a pretty well-established system with system development charges, local property taxes, and so on. It was kind of embarrassing, certainly for me, and I suspect everybody that's involved in the UGB expansion process, when we moved the boundary in the Bethany area, out in Clackamas County and other places, and realized we didn't have any money for, never mind water and sewer, we didn't have any money for the land use planning. I think what 827 is trying to get at is jump-starting a funding process to get us into a, hopefully, I don't think anybody pretend this is going to solve the problem. It's going to be a piece of the solution, I think, as Mr. Passport said, as part of the cash flow rectification. The bigger concern, I think, and it goes to what Senator Starr is talking about, how do we pay for this stuff? Who ought to pay for this stuff? Is it something we ought to figure, the infrastructure distribution and payment system ought to be part of the urban growth boundary expansion decisions, perhaps. We simply dumbed into a corner here, and I can say it's embarrassing. We didn't think about how much it ought to cost to serve the land. We didn't think about where the money's going to come from. A lot of folks probably did get a little carried away in their purchasing. I could argue that has to do with land scarcity as much as it has to do with anything else, but leave it alone. There's still a problem there of now going back in trying to shoehorn in additional infrastructure costs. There's a lot of concerns, as Senator Starr indicated, of other parts of a county or other parts of the metro region being asked to bear a burden that may or may not benefit them directly. Having said that, as Mr. Pastorf observed, it's oftentimes very difficult to figure out which infrastructure piece serves this development and therefore perhaps could be attributable to the people that live in that development versus which infrastructure piece improves the road system generally so that people in another part of the county or the region actually do see a benefit in terms of reduced traffic or better circulation flows or whatnot. It's the start of a big conversation. I know Metro's been engaged in this. We've been supportive of what they've been talking about in terms of the both, I think, as they're looking at it in the new look, but also in how to do urban growth boundary expansions generally. There's a couple bills in this legislature that will be in this committee, I suspect, dealing with that. It's a very difficult question. I'm not sure I'm willing to concede Senator Starr's point that folks in one part of this county ought not, as a matter of black letter law, pay for something in another part of the county, but I do understand the concern. And I think what we've missed in a lot of these conversations is a proper attribution of cost and benefit between newly developed areas, existing areas, and the broader, just the general tax system.
Well, certainly in the bill, the way it's structured, it's supposed to be a revolving loan fund, so by definition, it implies somebody's paying this back in order to keep it working. And part of the issue, as Senator Starr has indicated, is perhaps it would be beneficial to have some more clarity as to how that revolving fund would continue to revolve based on, you know, who would be the payee and the payor. Because I agree with you that, as I mentioned before, we have to find a way to provide infrastructure for community decisions and you know, for growth. But I can certainly understand Senator Starr's point of view if, particularly if some particular area in your county has people are skeptical about the investment that was made in it anyway, and then asking you to kind of make them come even, that makes it irritable a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that, and I don't mean to, I'm not discounting Senator Starr's position at all. I think he makes a very good point. in my mind, what we're really looking at with Senate Bill 827, the Metro conversation, and the school issue that Senator Starr referenced, is are symptoms of a tax system that's failing us and is not doing what it's designed to do. I know I was surprised to find out, because I didn't pay any attention when Measure 50 was being worked on by this legislature some years ago, other than three lines on page 40, how badly conceived that was in terms of how of having development pay on an ongoing basis what it needs to serve it. I think we probably need to look at our system and make sure that we are, in fact, capturing enough money for the public to provide infrastructure that the public needs, be it schools, water, sewer, roads. To do it through what our current system of impact fees or revolving loan funds or anything else is kind of a hit and miss. And it does result in people getting cranky and feeling very aggrieved that they're paying for something they're not using, which, whether they're right or wrong, doesn't matter. Still, that is a very real problem at the local level, and we need to address that. I think this bill gets some clarity as to who pays it back, how the fund revolves, I think makes sense. But I'm hoping that, I'm kind of making a pitch for other issues that are going to be in front of you this session, that we not lose sight of the fact that we really do need to pay more attention to infrastructure funding in this legislature. We need to pay more attention to who pays, how it gets paid, when it gets paid, how much gets paid, because we've simply ignored that, and we've assumed over the years that the money fair is going to show up and put roads in, and that hasn't happened, and it's not going to happen, and to do it through one method or another exclusively doesn't make sense.
Questions for Ms. Panel? Senator Moss Anderson.
More of a comment. It's an economic issue to Gresham, and we truly need to. We are trying to attract good businesses and family wage jobs to our area, and it's been just disheartening to see that we haven't been able to progress on our Powell Valley development just due to the very fact that we in Gresham, which has an extremely low tax base, is unable to come up with the funding to provide the infrastructure there. And so I'm very much see the reasonableness of this. I certainly understand the good senator from Hillsborough and his concern, but that's not Bethany definitely is not Gresham, and they have their unique issues in his district. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we have already got an amendment we need anyway, I think, on this bill. I would ask that Senator Moss Anderson, you talk with Senator Starr about some of the language, Ron, and see if there might be some clarity before we move the bill forward that would help that and solve some potentially bumpier ways down the road, and then we'll try and bring it back as quickly as we can. How's that?
Thank you.
Yes, Jen?
The chair is going to enter a letter into the record from 1,000 Friends. They are supportive of the revolving loan fund, not taking a position on how it's funded.
Yeah, I would just suggest that what this bill is a Band-Aid on a very broken system. Now, the fact that Metro expanded the urban growth boundary in areas that they did rather than areas where they should have, where the cost would be a lot less. You know, it's easy for them to say, oh, let's just go over here, and they don't care. In fact, in some respects, I would submit they don't want it to be developed. So,
well, Senator Starr, you know, your point is very valid in a lot of ways, and it gets all the political issues of urban growth expansions, and it... I think it really does beg the question, which is really important on this, is that especially we're talking about UGBs now in the metro area, because that's kind of what we're focused on here. So we're talking about the metro area, which the jurisdiction is a metro, and these oft battles of urban expansion all the time. And supposedly the decisions that emanate from those discussions are supposed to be the community at large, in other words, the metro area, knowing that all this growth is coming, has, as a community of citizens, made a decision where best to have that growth. But if it is a community decision, then one would argue then it has to be a community has to pay for it because they're the ones that decided to stick it out there or wherever that may be, either because they didn't want it or someone else wanted it. But it creates a real problem if you're the one that gets that development knighting without the money to actually do something for it. And you're, we all hear about it, certainly in Damascus, about, you know, we've been chosen to do this, but where's the money to, you know, because, you know, to put all these people. So it is something that the community decision and the community funding have not been put together.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, members of the committee, I, with Steve Bryant from the League and Michael Jordan from Metro did a little presentation for the LCDC a month or two back on the topic of the failure or absence, perhaps a better way to put it, of the land use system to look at infrastructure funding as part of the decision. It's not simply enough to say the growth ought to go here. You have to look at how does it go there. And if we're going to keep it off of Area A and put it into Area B, the costs of that and the weighing that has to be part of the equation simply has not been. And that does result in the disconnects that Senator Starr identified, where you have land prices going through the ceiling and infrastructure price going through the ceiling and no present ability to figure out how to pay for it. Different but similar issue to the one faced by Senator Mona Anderson out in her district that this bill is intended to address. But the point is, these conversations are taking place. Hopefully this committee and others in this body will be able to engage on this, because it's going to choke us sooner or later just because we haven't been smart enough to figure out how to do it differently.
Okay. Well, we will...
Good sermon.
Let's have that discussion, Ron and Bruce and others, and then we'll bring that bill back later. So we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 827. And we'll open public hearing on Senate Bill 545. Janet.
We're in the funerals now.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 545 would authorize funeral service practitioner apprentices to perform certain duties required of a person who first assumes custody of a body. And it modifies the initial licensure and reciprocity for funeral service practitioners and embalmers. And you have at your place the -2 amendments, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And they would make the language parallel for both the embalmer and the practitioner apprentices, the timing and the requirements of notice and examination. And would specify that licensed practitioners and embalmers may have no more than 3 interns at a time. There's both an internship kind of program and an apprenticeship program that are different. The main thing that Senate Bill 545 allows is for the apprenticeship to be served for an aggregate of up to 4 years. There's a minimum requirement of 12 months to apprenticeship, but this would allow it to be served over a period of 4 years, excluding military service or other interruptions that are acceptable to the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. So again, just in the conversation, make sure there's 2 apprenticeship programs, one for embalmers and one for practitioners, and there's also a separate internship program. Practitioners can only have 1 apprentice at any one time. Mr. Chair, and I understand there may be an additional amendment needed, so that person...
Okay, but Wally Ortman.
Do the -2s replace the -1s?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman. My client is the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. I have one of our members with us today to explain what the need was for the bill. And Janet's right, in discussions prior to this hearing with the Executive Director of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, I would like to come back one more time with just a couple of more changes, prepare some -3 amendments. But Wally will be able to address those two.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Ortman. I'm a 5th-generation funeral director from Albany and a past president of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. My testimony today culminates a lengthy process of evaluating apprenticeship and reciprocation law at the request of our membership, who have found the current statutes to be restrictive and in some cases prohibitive. The bill language and amendments are the remedies suggested by an OFDA committee and board, as well as staff of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board and Mount Hood Community College's Funeral Service Education Director. Regarding reciprocation, funeral homes have been frustrated at the inability to attract out-of-state licensees. Currently, a licensee in another state must have been licensed for the 2 years immediately prior to applying for licensure in Oregon, as well as coming from a state that has guidelines for licensure very similar to Oregon's. Senate Bill 545 would provide a more realistic cushion of time for obtaining a license in Oregon while more effectively recognizing the licensing authority of other states. Before any remarks on the apprenticeship remedies, it's important to note, as was noted by the committee administrator, that Oregon recognizes two licenses, the funeral service practitioner and the embalmer licenses. The funeral service practitioner license requires an associate degree, while the embalmer requires graduation from a funeral service education program. The duration of the required apprenticeship for each license is the same. The apprenticeship remedies in Senate Bill 545 don't change the duration of the apprenticeships, but rather provide for an aggregate time frame for completing apprenticeships as opposed to the restrictive consecutive 48 months as it stands now. Currently, the requirements don't allow for an apprentice to walk away, possibly for educational purposes, without that clock continuing to tick. The leave of absence that can be granted by the Mortuary and Cemetery Board would be unnecessary then in these circumstances. This bill also allows for a more realistic time frame for completing educational requirements and subsequent testing. The language in the amendments regarding interns through funeral service education programs would allow for mortuary school students to more easily find positions in the metro area for their required internships. Before entertaining any questions you may have, I'd like to add that this legislation is being proposed to make it more efficient for your local funeral directors to do business in Oregon. These remedies provide them much more flexibility in hiring and retaining employees while still maintaining the standards and credibility of our industry. The bill originally did not fully address our goals as it came out of LC, but the Dash 2 amendments more completely accomplish our original intent. The Dash 2 amendments more accurately parallel the two types of apprenticeship and add the language to help the funeral service education program at Mount Hood Community College and eliminate the word degree from associate programs. That being said, after consultation with the executive director of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, just prior to this hearing, we would ask that this bill be held over until Wednesday so that an additional change may be made.
Thank you, Mr. Ordeman. Well, I think I would start with, first of all, what's the additional change that we're going to be looking for?
It's possible that we would be able to simplify this bill and the language in this bill by eliminating the time frames. Excuse me, I should have properly addressed the chair. I apologize for that, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. The time frames regarding when you had to fulfill your educational requirement and then the time frame for when that was mandated for when you took your testing, it's possible that that language could be completely eliminated from the bill, having probably become obsolete. And in consultation with the executive director, it's possible that this bill will come back in a simpler form to you on Wednesday.
Okay, and I had another question. You comment about this is important because it will, because the status quo is such that you have an inability to attract out-of-state licensees, and you talked about the two-year, you know, must have been licensed at least 2 years before they come into Oregon, et cetera. Do I interpret that to mean that that we're actively trying to get people, you know, from out of state because we have a need here, and that this is, you know, our current laws make it very difficult to get those people into our system? Is that,
Chair Metzger,
is that an interpretation that would be accurate? Or?
Chair Metzger, it is prohibitive in some cases at this time. Each state has different requirements for their own licensing. Some states require apprenticeships, some do not. The interpretation in statute in Oregon is such at this time where it has become, interpreting what states are, quote, very similar to Oregon and who are not has made it a challenge to judge whether someone qualifies under Oregon law for reciprocation.
Do we have a
just in the industry, and because of your, obviously, with fifth-generation long-term background in this, has this been a profession that's been difficult to recruit to meet the needs of the state, I mean, like others, or, I mean, just what is the state of the industry in terms of the professionals needed to, you know, to maintain the industry and its service?
Chair Metzger, the answer to that question is the answer is that that issue has evolved over time, especially with large corporations purchasing multiple funeral homes and trying to laterally move their employees from one state to another. It has become a challenge. Also, I think you will find that funeral homes that are on the borders of our state, in trying to attract employees that possibly, say, a funeral home in Ontario, maybe somebody that's licensed in Idaho, there are challenges that way too. Funeral homes, in general, I believe do have trouble sometimes finding licensees for help. It's not an industry that people typically flock to. When you go to a high school career day, that's not something that people are clamoring to do. This legislation would open the door much wider for funeral homes to be able to attract proper licensing help, licensee help.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Yes.
It isn't necessarily a question, but I would agree totally regarding getting rid of any kind of year, putting years in here. I only relate it to the nursing profession, and sometimes I'll take 3 to 5 years to have a kid and then want to go back, and in this bill coming in here, that person wouldn't be able to participate. So is that what you want? We're thinking the amendments would get rid of?
Chair Metzger and Senator Anderson, that is exactly what we're talking about coming back on Wednesday with. Right now the statute is very prohibitive as far as the time frame, the apprenticeship and a 2-year window on either side of the apprenticeship for getting your testing done. We thought in this original language that we were making that a little more liberal, but now with the possibility of eliminating those time frames altogether would be a terrific remedy for our profession.
Okay. Any other questions? Any concerns by anybody? Okay, well, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 545, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 545 and close the work session on Senate Bill 545 so we can technically be able to bring the bill back on Wednesday. Okay. Now, let's go to a public hearing open on Senate Bill 894. Janet.
Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 894 is at the request of the, no, it's not. It's a Senator Devlin's bill that would authorize the Public Utility Commission to adopt rules that conform the Oregon Universal Service Fund to the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996. The -1 amendments that you have at your place would add authority for the PUC to adopt rules to conform to not just the statute, but rules adopted by the Federal Communications Commission that are related to universal service funds. There's a federal universal service program and a state one, and this provides basic telephone service, making it available at a reasonable cost to areas of the country that are expensive to serve or areas of the state. And conformance is an issue under the bill and the -1 amendments. Thank you.
Okay. Now, did Senator Devlin want to testify on this? I thought he had suggested something about calling him.
He is planning to come down at about 2 o'clock.
Well, do we know where to reach Mr. Devlin?
I believe he's office. Adam.
Could you call Senator Devlin and tell him we're doing his bill at the moment? And we'll start with asking Brant Wolf to come forward, because he is here. Tell us why we need this bill and what our amendment does. And
well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brant Wolf with the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and I think the sheet was taken up before Mr. Willis from PUC had a chance to sign up, but he would like to testify as well.
You're saying Mr. Willis was late, too?
No.
Mr. Willis, please come forward.
However,
here.
Ms. Taylor, the committee administrator is correct that this bill did come out of the Senate Bill 17 Task Force at the request of the legislators indicated on the bill. Basically, I'm here to testify in support of the bill because, as a member of the task force myself, I was given the task or assignment of chairing a subcommittee related to the State Universal Service Fund, so I feel some responsibility for the bill you have in front of you. It's the work of a lot of compromise over lots and lots of different meetings with all the parties at the table, and this bill was the bill that we, or the language that we came up with. Basically, as you indicated, or the committee administrator indicated, it would just allow the commission to conform or sync up with what's happening on a federal level. If the FCC changes its contribution methodology for the federal fund, then the state commission can mirror that. And basically, in a nutshell, that's what it does. The industry supports that measure. It doesn't broaden the base of who would contribute. It just changes the contribution methodology. So we support that measure. And that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions
okay.
anybody had.
Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll go to Senator Devlin. Mr. Wolf has pretty well talked about the what the bill does, but you can give us the your commission's overview, if you'd like, Senator Devlin, and why this is important to be able to conform.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did Mr. Willis give you an overview?
No,
of
he has
commission?
Not. Mr. Wolf. No, we've heard from Mr. Wolf. We're now hearing
okay.
from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This particular measure you have in front of you comes from the SB 17 task force that met throughout the interim and met and considered many issues relative to telecommunications, including economic regulations of wireline services, service quality regulations, standardized service quality, reviewing the structure of the Federal Universal Service Fund and the Oregon Universal Service Fund, which is why you have the one measure here in front of you. The basic issues in terms of competition and whether or not we have a level playing field for all carriers, which I think it's clearly the conclusion of most people that we do not. Consumer protection, broadband availability, platform convergence and the relevant federal legislation, and how to get laws in conformance with the 1996 Telecommunications Act before the next act is actually approved by Congress. And that's actually another small bill that you actually have that I believe has been assigned to this committee. Using a consensus approach, which was how the task force was directed, we could come out to conclusion on very few items or come to agreement on very few items. In fact, I think you will see some examples of some of the areas that we came close to agreement on but not complete agreement on being considered now as amendments to various bills in the House, which ultimately might come to this committee should they make it out of the House. But in terms of this one area, I think as already been presented here, this is pretty much a housekeeping resolution, although it is needed by the PUC Commission. That in the case that they changed the, and it may have already changed for what I know at this particular point, that the PUC has clear authority to adjust the computation of these rates. And I think that you also have a dash one amendment, which is from the PUC, which actually just clarifies the language a little bit more.
Thank you, Senator. We'll go to Mr. Willis, and we have your written testimony and the on the current methodology used by the FCC and the flexibility that you want. So you might, give us your overview of that and why that's best for customers and why that provides some sense of continuity for the providers as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rick Willis with the Public Utility Commission. The commission does support the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 894. As mentioned, it is a consensus of the SB 17 task force. Let me explain a little bit about what the Universal Service Fund is. The purpose of the fund is to ensure that basic telephone service is available at reasonable and affordable rates in areas of the state that are costly to serve. This bill would allow us to conform our rules on the Oregon Universal Service Fund to the federal fund, to the 1996 Federal Act and related FCC rules interpreting that act. Currently, the FCC funds the federal universal service programs by imposing a percentage surcharge on retail, telecommunications, interstate, and international long-distance revenue. The FCC does this by rule because the 96 Act does not specify how it will be done, so the FCC is left to interpret it by rule. In contrast, Oregon's methodology for funding Oregon's Universal Service Fund is in statute, which is why we're here today. The mechanism that Oregon uses currently syncs up very well with what the federal folks do, and that is we impose a percentage surcharge on Oregon retail telecommunications revenues. However, it looks likely that that will change. The FCC is seriously considering replacing the current funding mechanism with one that is a fixed surcharge on telephone numbers. If they do make that change, under Oregon law, PUC does not have the authority to mirror that change. And that does cause a number of problems for both the carriers as well as us. We will have two different systems for imposing the fees for universal service. So the SB 17 task force looked at this issue and recommended that the law be changed to grant us authority to adopt rules that would have us sync up and mirror what the FCC is doing, and that's this bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wells. So just to kind of recap here, you would engage in this rulemaking if, in fact, the FCC made a change in how they calculate, and in engaging that rulemaking, then the providers would be at the table in helping to define that rule as per other decisions by the PUC.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The pertinent number charge, would that apply to cell phone numbers?
No, it doesn't. It's just landlines.
Would that...
Mr. Chair, excuse me.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Would the per-line charge apply to voice-over internet VoIP numbers?
At this point, I don't think that's been decided. I don't think so either. Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I don't think that's been decided. I don't believe that's the case.
Yes, so no. The answer is no?
No.
Then one last question. In your testimony, in the last sentence of your testimony on page 1, the purpose of the universal service funding is to ensure basic telephone services available at reasonable and affordable rates in areas of the state that are costly to serve. The question I have is, when will that task be accomplished and we can eliminate this fee? It seems to me that you've been able to provide telephone service, I don't know how soon, and we still have folks out there that don't have telephones in their houses, and we got to tax everybody else to fund, you know, these remote telephone lines. At what point will we get the last telephone out there in the hinterlands, and we can eliminate this fee?
Looks like Senator Devlin would like to respond to that. He's been itching there since you started asking it.
I saw him wave.
Yes.
We had an extremely extensive discussion of universal service charges both at the federal level and at the state level. And we even considered the potential of entertaining legislation to either reduce or eliminate the state level. And after much discussion, we decided to keep the current system. And it's not so much just gaining access. It's that actually some telecommunications providers, particularly to some rural area, it's not simply a matter of getting the line there. It's the matter of the cost of providing the service also on a continual basis, and also changes in technology. I did want to state something for the record, though, Mr. Chairman, in case anyone here is interested in how this consensus was reached. Realize that in this task force, there were consumer interests represented in terms of CUB. There were cable interests represented, wireless interests representative, ILEX and CLEX. Just about anybody in telecommunications you could possibly imagine. And this was one of the areas where there was no disagreement. And if you ever sat through one of these meetings, finding any area where there was no disagreement was almost impossible, but this was one of two areas in which we had no disagreement.
Mr. Willis, do you care to answer my question?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, kind of to reiterate what Senator Devlin said, that a lot of this has to do with ongoing expenses. You're right when you say that there are certain startup costs that happen with new phones out in very rural areas, but it's also just more expensive to serve them on a daily basis. When they have to go to repair a line in a neighborhood, they go from one house to the next. They may go a block. Out in some of these areas, they may go 20 miles.
Mr. Chair, yeah. And Mr. Willis, isn't that kind of the reality if a person chooses to live in a rural area that serving somebody that lives, I mean, there's just added costs. When you live in a rural area, you pay more in transportation costs because you live in a rural area. There's certain choices that folks that live in the rural area, you know, there's choice here. I mean, they could choose to live in a neighborhood and then have a house next door. I'm just curious to know that I think you maybe need to change your purpose. If it's not what it lists here, if it's something else, you might just want to change that. It looks like this fee is going to go on forever. And at some point, maybe the definition of basic telephone service will include, broadband service, and so that folks can get on the telephone and not have any interruptions whatsoever. I don't know. It just seems to me that there's certain costs that are associated with folks that live in rural areas that they chose, and this fee requires the rest of us to bear that burden for them. I don't know if that's a question, and I guess it's a statement.
Well, I think, Senator Starr, you're right. I mean, it is, and it's been a policy choice that I think, the country has made, and certainly the state has made, that basic dial tone, as they call it, should be accessible regardless, and we have subsidized that. And it is you're certainly right about the choice,
point,
of,
already, if,
choice
if,
of that.
If they have the dial tone, then we're going to continue to pay for it forever, I guess.
Yeah, so... That has been a policy choice since, I guess, we can change that, but Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just got a quick question on the structure of both the bill and the amendments. I understand we need to sync up with the feds on this. Explain to me the very last line. We'll just look at the bill in line 10. To the extent that the commission determines appropriate. And I guess I'm trying to figure out why if we want to sync up with what the federal government does, why do we need to give... It seems like we should give some clear direction to the commission to write rules that conform to the Universal Service Fund. What would be outside the extent that the commission determined appropriate, I guess, is my question. And why do we need to have that particular line in this whole thing? I'd like it to be more clear, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we don't know exactly what the FCC is going to do. They may have things within their regulation that are not appropriate for Oregon. So we would go through a rulemaking, again, with all the interested parties there, to make sure that ours sync up as well as it should for Oregon. But we didn't want to say, and I don't think the task force wanted to say, just carte blanche to whatever the FCC does, to just automatically adopt that without some consideration for what happens within Oregon. So there could be some parts that... as part of the rule review, that folks look at it and say, we don't want to adopt this piece, or maybe we want to go a little further on that piece. So it allows the latitude for the parties to get together and say, we want to sync up, but not word for word with FCC.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Could you give me an example of what we're... I mean, I guess for me, I'm always nervous when we... I mean, I have any problem with the commission writing rules. I just want to know exactly where you're headed with them when that starts down that path. And so I'm just trying to kind of figure out how broad of an authority we're granting, because it's the current language in the law is pretty succinct. It says the Universal Service Fund shall conform. And then we're giving you rule writing authority now, and I guess what I'm trying to do is figure out how far afield you folks could go with this particular language away from conforming with the federal law.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, not very far, because the new language still states that we will conform and sync up with the feds. We just don't have to take it word from the feds. So I don't think that the new language gives us very broad authority to go too far afield on this, nor do I think the parties would allow us to go too far afield.
Mr. Chair, yeah. One last question. On the dash one amendments, which you testified to, there's a change on page two that I'm not understanding, and has to do with, again, it says, unless otherwise provided by the Public Utility Commission by rule, and then it goes on to say the surcharge shall be established by the commission as a uniform percentage. Explain to me the need for the dash one, page two amendments, if you would.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the need for that is that currently in law, let me borrow this, it calls for the commission to use a uniform percentage. So unless we take that out and replace it with this language, we would be stuck with that percentage. And if the FCC goes to a per-line charge, gets rid of the percentage, and goes to a per-line charge, then we can't conform anymore.
Sure.
Yes, Janet?
I just have a question about the potential FCC rule. It seems like a per-line charge would have more effect on low-income people than something based on revenues if they don't, you know, they don't use their phone very much, but they'd still get this charge. And I don't know how much the charge is, but it does, that seems like it would be a factor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the revenue charge is on the company, in the company. Okay, it's not on the individual. Okay, so it's how many lines the company has,
okay.
How much revenue the company has.
Okay, so, all right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Well, I think what we'll do is we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 894. We'll open our work session for the purpose of discussion.
Chair, I'll move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 894.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 894. Discussion on the amendment.
Question for Mr. Willis. When do you expect the federal rule change to be implemented or come into effect?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I'm hesitating because trying to predict the FCC is very tricky business. Possibly later this year. It could be next year, but possibly later this year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Chair, yeah. Further follow-up. We don't have to pass this bill. I mean, we could wait until February to address this issue, and quite honestly, we could just change the statute to accommodate the FCC change rather than provide the PUC additional rulemaking authority. Isn't that correct?
Looks like, well, Senator, Mr. Wallace, why don't you respond to that, and then let's let Senator Devlin say what he was going to say.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did want, and I think the task force wanted us to have a little latitude, because we don't know exactly what the FCC is going to do. Some of that is up in the air. And so, in answer to your question, I suppose you could wait to see what the FCC does and then write a law that has us do that specifically. Problem is, if the FCC changes again next year, the year after, we're going to have to keep coming back and back and back to adjust and adjust and adjust, depending on the whims of the FCC. And I think one of the things the task force said was, wouldn't it be a whole lot easier to put it in rule and be able to go through that process, a easier process, if you will, to sync up with the FCC?
Senator Devlin?
Yes. I think we had literally hours of debate on this, and there was agreement of all of the parties. And I think when you think about a February session, you should think of the fact that we only have 20 actual weekdays in that February session, and no decision has been made. But I would have my doubts whether a bill of this magnitude would be on the list of bills that would be considered during that February session. I think that's still a discussion that will occur in this building before we get out this time, but I don't think we're going to come back in February and try to correct this. Also, in terms of the FCC, one of the things that we found, or particularly I found during the interim working on this task force, is we never know particularly what the FCC is going to do and when they're going to do it. I'll give you an example. Not long before we finished our work, the FCC made the determination about the process in which companies like Verizon can obtain franchises for videos service in various counties. That process was, I believe, concluded in Washington County not long ago. But that was a totally different than what we saw 6 months or a year ahead of that time. So, I mean, I think the PUC does have to have some flexibility to react to changes that the FCC makes. Without that flexibility, I think they'd be constantly coming back here to adjust practically everything that they do.
Any other thoughts? Comments?
I like Senator Starr's idea. I mean, I guess, man, just I always get nervous whenever we take something that's pretty defined, which is sticking to the federal law, and we just change it and say adopt rules, which I'm fine with, to give you some flexibility. But then this additional line, to the extent that the commission terms appropriate, goes beyond that flexibility. That's my problem with this, is that I understand that the FCC may change that, and you guys may need that flexibility. So I understand the purpose of the rules, but then we give the commission even additional flexibility, and I just, that right there, I'd like to know what that additional flexibility is. That's my only concern on this.
Mr. Wolf, I think you better comment, because the committee may be indicating they won't want to do this, and you're the ones that might have to pay the two different systems. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe me, Senator George, there is no one who wants to give less authority to the commission than me. I can only tell you that this bill, what we tried to do was a compromise on all the parties. As Senator Devlin indicated, there were consumers, all the industry was represented, and this is what we all agreed on. So all the parties agreed that what we're doing here is what we want to do. We want to give the commission the authority to be flexible to change as the federal commission changes. And to the extent that this bill does that, we support that idea. Absolutely. And I appreciate your hesitation.
Mr. Wolf, is it just from your standpoint and the folks that you represent, let's say we didn't go forward with this bill. Let's say the FCC did change their methodology and went on a per-line rate as opposed to a percentage rate. And so you would be paying that per-line rate on the federal level. You would still have to do the calculation on the assess for the state level. Does that cause you any particular heartburn one way or another? Or
yes, Mr. Chair. It would just be smoother, I guess, is a good way to state it. If you have to do some kind of a calculation on one part of the bill and then just assess a pure, per 75 cents, let's say, per line charge on the other part of the bill, it would make it easier from an accounting point of view, from just a keeping it clean kind of point of view.
Okay. Any thoughts?
If I may, I have to speak to Senator Starr's concern about the cost to everybody. And the reason we have these surcharges here is because it was in 1996 when that act was passed, it was determined that these charges, which used to be kind of hidden on your bill, would be explicit, so a consumer would know exactly how much they were paying. It used to be it was called implicit. You paid it in access charges and high long distance rates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is just explicit. So you've always paid it. As the chair indicated, it's been a longstanding public policy. And I just wanted to state that for the record.
And we're just going to keep paying.
Thank you.
Well, what is the desire of the committee?
We have a motion on the table, I think.
Yeah. We have a dash one. Okay.
I'm okay.
Okay. So, any objections to the dash one? All right. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to Senate floor as amended with due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 894 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
I'm not in love with it, but
if I okay. Note that Senator Starr is not in love with it. And Senator Decker is excused. If there's
one quick comment.
Yes.
And I'm supporting this with the assurance from the commission that their flexibility will be narrow in their rule writing. So thank you very much.
All right. No objections? All right. So ordered. And Senator Devlin, I'll ask you to carry the bill. Okay. With that, committee, we are adjourned.